Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and on Connect the Dots, we regularly talk about policy, advocacy, science, health, and media with various doctors, scientists, authors, thought leaders, experts, advocates, organizers, filmmakers, and a whole host of other people that talk about the many things in our interconnected world that affect us and our personal and community well-being. Each week on the show, we talk about how the health of our food, water, air, and earth and products affect our health, about the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the ecological balance of planet Earth. On today's show, I'm really honored to have with me a very special scientist who is a true pioneer in the domain of environmental health and someone who has been, through my following his research and his work and attending his seminars over many years, well over a decade, someone that has helped teach me about the important intersection of the impacts that come to us from our world. Today, our guest will be Philip J. Landrigan, MD and Master of Science. It sounds, Dr. Landrigan, like you're getting over this horrible flu we've had this season.
I'm sorry to inflict it on you, but at least I'm not contagious over the telephone.
Well, so many people have had it. And it's just incredible. But thank you for, coming to talk to us today, even while suffering with it. It can't, a lot of people have been very troubled by this particular year's flu. And as you would well know, as a pediatrician and epidemiologist, as I was mentioning, you were an internationally recognized pioneer in children's environmental health. When you began doing studies, and informing and educating scientists and policymakers and ordinary citizens, really, you were one of the first people looking into this after, the kind of call had been sounded by Rachel Carson to, kind of pay more attention. And I think in this age of corporate, development and technological development, many industries, we just, for many, many years, people really took for granted that everything that came about through the wonders of modern chemistry was just fantastic, and we've had a real wake-up call. Dr. Landrigan's studies of childhood lead poisoning catalyzed the removal of lead from gasoline, an action that reduced childhood lead poisoning in the U.S. by over 90% and has thereby raised the IQ of children all around the world. Also, Dr. Landrigan's studies on children's vulnerability to pesticides triggered a passage in the Food Quality Protection Act, which is the national government's pesticide law. And it's it's the only U.S. environmental law with standards explicitly protecting the health of children. Dr. Landrigan has a new book out, hot off the presses, called Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know. It's co-written with Mary M. Landrigan, who is both, a health leader in her own right, a public health educator and former healthcare administrator with 25 years of experience at the Westchester County Department of Health. The co-author with you of an earlier book, Raising Healthy Children in a Toxic World, and she is also your wife. So what a great partnership,
yes.
And, that's just fantastic. The excellent book, which is a real handbook, which I feel so happy to have for all the foundation for my own reporting, is dedicated to the Landrigan's children and grandchildren. And, this is just so important, it can't be overstated. So welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the very generous introduction. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Dr. Landrigan, I think in a way, as has been said over and over and over, you know, 85,000 chemicals kind of came through the gate without really being carefully studied for their health impacts. And so we are kind of in this situation of playing a game of catch-up. This is something I regularly report on, various facets of it, from all different angles. But, you know, with today's show, I think, you know, we've taken it for granted for ourselves, but the health impacts are actually really being seen more seriously in our children. Why are children more vulnerable, and what health impacts are now clearly shown by the science as, you know, toxic chemicals released in various forms of agriculture and products impacting children. You know, why are they more vulnerable, and what does the science that we now have show?
Yes, well, this is a point that we've been studying for almost 25 years, starting with work that the colleagues and I did in the early 1990s at the National Academy of Sciences. And through this work, we've defined several reasons as to why children are much more sensitive, much more vulnerable to toxic chemicals than adults. The first is that pound for pound, children are much more heavily exposed to chemicals in their environment than adults. They breathe much more air per pound, they drink more water, they eat more food. So if any toxic chemicals are in air, water, or food, children get proportionately more of those chemicals into their body. And then on top of that, kids do things that most adults don't do. They roll around on the floor, they put their fingers in their mouths, and all of those actions have the potential to increase children's exposure to toxins that are in dust or in soil. So greater exposure is the first reason children are more sensitive. The second is that children are just fundamentally more vulnerable. Their biology is different from the biology of adults. Their organ systems are growing and developing. The development of organs like the heart, the brain, the immune system, the reproductive organs is extraordinarily complex. Hundreds, thousands of separate developmental events need to happen during the 9 months of pregnancy and in the first years after birth. All of those events have to take place at the proper time, in the proper sequence. And the upside of this complexity is that we have wonderful brains. We can think great thoughts. We have hearts that will run for 7, 8, 9 decades. But the downside of this complexity is that it's altogether too easily disrupted. And we now know that even very small doses of toxic chemicals during pregnancy, during the first years after birth, can cause permanent damage to a child. I'm talking about doses that would bounce off of you or me, doses that would bounce off of any adult, cause no negative effect whatsoever, can get into a mom's body while she's pregnant and pass through into her baby and cause damage there, or chemicals that are very small doses of chemicals like lead or pesticides that little kids are exposed to in their homes, in their schools, out in their backyards. So children are more heavily exposed, they're more vulnerable because of their unique biology. And the third reason that children are more vulnerable is that they've got many, many years ahead of them, 7, 8, 9 decades ahead of them. And why is that relevant? It's relevant because we now know that many chronic diseases, things like cancer, heart disease, kidney disease, even dementia, Alzheimer's disease, take decades to develop, that there are a whole series of changes that need to take place within the cells in the body. And if some of those changes are triggered by toxic exposures early in life, it pushes up the risk later in life that the child will develop one of these bad diseases. So there's multiple reasons to protect children against toxic chemicals. It protects their health here and now, but it also protects their health for the future. Now, you ask, what's the science teaching us? And what we've learned over the past 25 or 30 years through careful studies, mostly studies of populations of children, epidemiologic studies, we've been able to connect the dots between very specific toxic exposures in early life and specific health problems in children. This work started with studies of lead, where we showed that very small exposures to lead in the womb or in early childhood could reduce a child's IQ, shorten their attention span, disrupt their behavior. And in fact, longer follow-up studies of those children who had been exposed to lead showed that as they moved into their teen years and early adult years, the children who had been exposed to lead were more likely to engage in violent, even criminal behavior than other children from the same communities. So it began with lead, but we've now established a whole series of linkages between toxic exposures in early life and disease in children. Just let me name a few very quickly, and then if you want to talk about any of them in more detail, we could gladly do so. So we know, for example, that air pollution causes asthma and other forms of respiratory disease. We also know that if a mom is exposed to air pollution during pregnancy, it increases the risk that she'll give birth to a baby of low birth weight. We know that not only lead, but also mercury, PCBs, organophosphate pesticides, brominated flame retardants, all of those chemicals and others as well can cause brain damage to the infant that results in loss of IQ and behavioral problems. And we have learned that some of the newer chemicals that go under the name of endocrine disruptors, like phthalates, phthalates is a plastics chemical, and we've learned that if a mom is exposed to phthalates while she's pregnant, those chemicals get into her body, they can pass through to her baby, and they increase the risk that a baby boy will be born with reproductive congenital malformations of his reproductive organs. So these big studies have really generated a lot of information. The best of these studies are longitudinal studies, and by that I mean we enroll pregnant women. We enroll women while they're pregnant, sometimes even before they're pregnant. We take blood samples, urine samples, get very careful histories from these women while they're pregnant, and then we measure these biological samples for a whole mess of chemicals. And the great advantage of collecting samples during pregnancy is you're measuring the exposure that the fetus is experiencing in real time as the child is actually being exposed. And then you follow the child and you do exams periodically as the child grows up, like 3 years, 5, 7, 10 years, and do very careful examinations of the children at that time. And when you embark on that kind of study, it becomes possible to very specifically connect an exposure that occurred during pregnancy with a health problem in the child 5 or 8 or 10 or 12 years later. Very powerful studies, very effective at establishing cause and effect relationships.
So, you know, what you're saying is, for many years there was kind of in people's minds, a disconnect, in a sense that these chemicals would not have been released had they not been safe. And also a lack of a belief that there's a correlation between a given chemical and certain, negative health symptoms and risks and outcomes and stuff like that. So, what you're saying is that now as time has passed, the studies have been done over many years and really demonstrating these kinds of risks. And yet, for example, I mean, I was recently in a discussion with a group of younger women who were, either contemplating becoming pregnant or somebody was pregnant and asking other women, what did you do? And there was kind of a lack of awareness. That phthalates, for example, which are in nail polish and other perfumes and scents that are in everything, lotions, beauty products, all kinds of things, that wasn't a matter of greater public awareness. And the resulting, kind of negative health effects that you've just detailed are, I've heard of practitioners seeing families, where these and other, you know, very difficult symptoms are showing up, and yet there's kind of a disconnect in people's minds. And, you know, you mentioned lower IQ with lead. You know, it's, you know, with the sequence of this science, we now can see more about what these impacts are. And yet in people's minds, it's like, oh, it could be the school system that's a problem. How come they don't discipline children as they used to when I was young? you know, like some of the behavioral issues, some of the IQ issues and other things are, you know, regarded as just kind of the responsibility that the family, you know, isn't properly disciplining their child, for example.
Yes, yes. So there's I think there's several things in what you just said, very, very thoughtful comments. I think you're absolutely correct that for many, many years in this country, and really still continuing to the present time, the chemical industry has been given a free pass, that the new chemicals are allowed to come on the market with very, very little or none or no assessment at all of their safety or of their possible toxicity to children. Chemicals are basically assumed to be safe unless they're found to be harmful. And the sad reality is that time and time and time again, we have found that chemicals that were brought to the market with great enthusiasm, with great fanfare, we found 5, 10, 20 years later that they caused problems with brain damage, reproductive problems, or in other cases, damage to the environment, like the chlorofluorocarbons that almost destroyed the high altitude ozone layer that protects us all against the solar ultraviolet radiation. And there's just been a lack of due diligence about chemicals. People have just believed, they've accepted the notion that if the chemical is in their market and it's neatly packaged, it must be safe. And that's just not true. I mean, we talk about this in the book. We talk about how chemicals have come to market, and we detail multiple examples of how chemicals that were thought to be safe later were shown to cause harm. Now, the Europeans are approaching this issue very differently from us. About 10 years ago, 12 years ago, in 2007, the European Union passed legislation called REACH, R-E-A-C-H, which is and under REACH, which is chemical safety legislation, new chemicals have to be tested quite rigorously before they're allowed to come on markets. The mantra in Europe is no data, no market. And that's good. It's protecting the health of children living in Europe. An unfortunate consequence of it, though, of REACH, is that multinationals who do business both in Europe as well as in the United States are now dumping products in North America. And we talk about that in the book as well.
They're dumping products in North America. In other words, poor cousin that gets the garbage product because the Europeans will no longer accept it. I mean, why would they not stop making the garbage product? Is it cheaper for them to make the garbage product and dump it on us?
Yeah, I think it's cheaper. There's a book that I can recommend to you and to your listeners by a man named Michael Shapiro, written a few years ago, called Poisoned, which describes this in considerable detail.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about making our country great, or that our country is great, and, you know, it isn't going to be great for very long if you know, people are, kind of allowed to be poisoned. One of the areas that I've also, or a policy that I've also reported on extensively, are the over since about 2014 or so, are the international trade agreements, and the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, NAFTA are two of the better well-known ones that were at issue. The TPP was at issue during the last presidential election. And one of my big concerns about those kinds of deals is that for the sake of removing what is called barriers to trade, there were proposals to level the rules globally. So in other words, you know, if someone in Europe wants to sell their product and we want to sell our product, you know, there was a lot of talk of bringing the REACH and European rules, which are better, down to our level to facilitate trade. And, you know, so that we wouldn't really, you know, instead of rising to their level, they would have been forced to descend to our level. And, in fact, there was very strong European opposition through the TTIP, which was another deal that affected Europe. And, you know, through that deal, precisely, you know, for these very reasons. So, you know, that's also something like, you know, we're constantly trying to do the job of getting better policy. But if we sign, you know, an international trade deal with the wrong language, we could, you know, our poor standard, or even worse, an even worse standard than our own, could become the global norm everywhere. And so one of the reasons for my opposition was to that deal and my extensive reporting on it was due to that concern. Of course, this also crops up, not to use a pun, in food and agriculture. And I thought that in my book and listeners, we're talking today to Dr. Philip Landrigan, the author of Children and Environmental Toxins. But I thought your explanation of pesticides and glyphosate and the debate over genetically modified foods was one of the clearest I've ever heard. For some reason, because there is some complexity, sometimes discussed, confusion enters in. And, you know, I wanted to ask you to share your scientific understanding about that, because also that is another area of industry, you know, agriculture and food that travels internationally and where these different rules apply. And Europe also has been very strongly, much more so than in our country, in opposition to GMO foods. And I thought your explanation of their health risks as well as their environmental risks was, you know, kind of really clear and right on the money, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with our listeners.
No, I'd be very happy to talk about that, Allison. So we all know that there's been a great deal of discussion about the pros and cons, the safety or the lack of safety of GMO foods. And is that simply moving genes around in a plant is not harmful by itself, unless, of course, somebody uses genetic engineering to put a harmful chemical into the plant. But that's not what we're talking about here. Farmers have been doing crop selection for millennia. They pick the plant that produces the biggest ear of corn, the most beautiful rose, the biggest peach, and so on. And all of that is genetic engineering on a small scale. The only difference between then and now is that today plant geneticists can actually tease apart, dissect the plant DNA and remove certain traits or add new traits. Now, when genetic engineering of plants came along 10 or 20 years ago, there was a lot of enthusiasm that the food industry would do great things for humanity. For example, they could introduce genes that would allow farmers to grow crops in coastal soils that had salt pollution from the ocean, or that they could put in genes that would allow farmers to grow crops in very dry and arid regions of the country where it's hard to grow wheat or grow corn. All of those lovely scenarios were discussed. But instead, what the chemical manufacturing industry and the big food industry have chosen to do is to introduce genes that make the crops resistant to herbicides, which is, from a marketing point of view, it's very clever, because they can sell these modified seeds to the farmers, and then they also sell the farmers the herbicides against which these plants are protected. Now, when these the biggest herbicide on the market, on the world market, the most widely used herbicide in this country goes by the chemical name of glyphosate, goes by the brand name of Roundup. And the seeds that are resistant to this herbicide are called Roundup Ready crops. Now, when Roundup Ready seeds first came on the market more than a decade ago, it was a wonderful gift to the farmers because it spared them the need to weed their crops. Back in the old days, back more than a decade ago, the way farmers dealt with weeds was the following. They would apply Roundup one time only. They would apply it in February or March before they put the seeds in the ground, and the chemical was intended to kill any weeds that had survived the winter. Then they'd plant their crops, the crops would grow, and periodically the farmers would go through the fields with a hoe or with a tractor and weed the farm. When the Roundup Ready crops came along, the farmers would still treat the land in February or March before spring planting. But then as the season went along and the crops grew, the farmers no longer had to do the backbreaking work of mechanical weeding. Instead, they could just spray every now and then and knock down the weeds. And the corn, the wheat, the soybeans, the sugar beets that had the Roundup Ready gene in it would not be knocked down, and the weeds would be knocked out. And for the first few years, it worked like a charm. But then what happened was that the weeds began to adapt. Just as in the hospital, we know that if you misuse antibiotics, you produce organisms, germs, that are resistant to the antibiotics. That's why pediatricians these days are very careful about not over-prescribing antibiotics to children with viral infections. Well, the same thing with the plants. After they were treated with glyphosate over a few years, certain plant strains emerged that were resistant to glyphosate. They picked up the same genes. And consequently, the farmers had to spray more and more and more and more of the herbicide, and they had to spray it later and later and later in the growing season. And that's important because the later the farmer applies the herbicide in the growing season, the more likely the herbicide is to carry forward into the food crop, into the corn meal, which gets into your potato chips, for example, or your corn chips. If you apply the herbicide early in the year, the rain washes it off over the course of the growing season. But if you apply it just a week or two before harvest, likelihood is high that the herbicide is still going to be on the corn at the time it's picked and then get into people. And that is significant for human health because the World Health Organization determined in 2015 that glyphosate, Roundup, is what they call a probable human carcinogen, a chemical that probably, in their opinion, causes cancer in humans. It's not proven to cause cancer the way asbestos is, for example, but it's the next level down, what they call a probable human carcinogen. Now, of course, Monsanto, which is the company that makes glyphosate, challenges that assertion. But you have to remember that the World Health Organization is a totally independent body. They're not in the pocket of any industry. Industry consultants are not allowed to serve on World Health Organization committees, for example. And so an honest, independent, unpaid body has declared that this material is a probable human carcinogen. So all of that brings us around. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Keep going.
Okay, so all of this brings us around to the question of organic food. So when a person goes into a supermarket and buys certified organic food, they're buying food that has received little or no treatment with pesticides, and they're buying food that is not genetically modified. And like I said at the beginning of this part of the conversation, I don't think genetic modification by itself poses any hazard to human health whatsoever. But I think that the use of, or the misuse of genetically modified crops and the very, very heavy application of herbicides that is required to maintain those crops looks to me like it poses potentially serious problems for human health. And so I tell people, I tell patients, I tell families that to the extent they can afford to do so, I know there's a cost issue here, but I say to the extent you can afford to do so, eat organic. There have been very good studies which show that people who eat a mainly organic diet have 90% lower levels of pesticides in their body than people who eat foods that have been grown with pesticides, so-called conventionally treated foods.
Well,
I think this is a big deal. I think it's complicated, which it makes it hard for people to understand, but I simplify it by saying eat organic, and that way you avoid most of the pesticides. You protect your children against these pesticides, that some of which can damage the nervous system, and some, like glyphosate, are considered to be probable human carcinogens.
Well, I'm a great proponent of that for people who could afford it. I wish that we could change, you know, agricultural policy so that more people could afford it, because it's, you know, it's troubling that it's an economic issue and that some people, you know, are not able to make that choice. And it's very often have other health hits afflicting them.
That's absolutely true. Although I'm cautiously optimistic here, because more and more farmers are starting to grow organically. And I know in New York City, for example, where I live, the state of New York actually provides some financial incentives to farmers who actually want to come in and do farmers markets one day or 2 days a week in some of the poorest mm-hmm. neighborhoods in New York City, for example, in Harlem, in parts of Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a model
fantastic.
There.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's really important. That's great. Now, New York is, we can't always grow our own food, but we, you know, it is a great environment that takes that very seriously and tries to set up programs that compensate. You know, I just want to pick up a thread from something else that you said as we were discussing the studies on the probable carcinogenicity, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, of glyphosate. And one of the things you said in talking about the World Health Organization and its studies is that these are independent scientists who cannot be serving on companies or have any other agenda as they come together to make a scientific determination. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting dilemma nowadays, you know, and I say this as someone who's reported on science, you know, for many decades. We want people to be able to trust science. It's essential to, you know, be able to believe that science is real, rather than distorted or itself contaminated in some kind of way. And, you know, and yet when the term science-based or evidence-based is used, there's a question, because not all scientific research is independent, as, you know, you so carefully described when we were talking about the World Health Organization. I'd love to hear your comments about that and the progression by which science that is not independent kind of has a big say in what is studied and what we call science and what we regard as scientific proof, and how would you suggest that the average person, you know, can make an easy distinction when claims are made for science, but maybe not all of them or many are independent, or many of them are not independent at all. What's your view of that, and how do people navigate it?
Well, this is difficult, because the big industries in this country and around the world have unfortunately identified scientists who are willing to work for money and produce papers that come to predetermined conclusions. There have even been examples of what's called ghostwriting, where the chemical companies have written the papers and the scientist simply attaches his name or her name to the paper after the fact. And a book that you and your readers might be interested to look at was written by a man named David Michaels, who was the director of OSHA during the last federal administration. And his book, it's called Doubt Is Their Product, talks about how certain industries have become very, very skilled at generating pseudoscience. This began with the tobacco industry, who for years and years found scientists who were willing to work for very handsome salaries and produce papers saying that smoking didn't cause lung cancer. And then the asbestos industry got into the act, and they were able to find scientists who would take very nice amounts of money and report that asbestos did not cause cancer. And now more recently, this harmful trend has come into has come to surround many other chemicals. There's actually a trial that just started up, I think, in Oregon or Washington State a few days ago, where a number of plaintiffs are bringing suit against Monsanto, and some of these issues of science for hire will be discussed, I'm told, at that trial.
That's very interesting. When what you're describing happens, which is companies with deep pockets buying science, pushing research down a certain road, wanting to study some things and maybe not others, does that, in addition to the confusion created by the so-called science that results from that, does that create an inhospitable or tougher environment to get more, scientific research of greater authenticity and integrity funded?
Well, I think what this does is it creates skepticism in the minds of many of the American public about science. You know, and unfortunately, the way these issues often get reported on the news is the reporter will say that one group of scientists says the chemical causes harm, but on the other hand, there's a second group of scientists who say it causes no harm. The American public hears that. They say to themselves, the scientists can't agree, so I'm not going to worry about it.
That's right. Well, I think that's very true. And most people then aren't thinking one group of scientists, is being corrupted and the other may not be. I mean, they don't kind of, how would a member of the public even be able to discern that?
Well, it's very hard for members of the public to discern that. I'll tell you, though, what some of the big journals are doing, especially the medical journals. The medical journals, the top ones, like the Journal of the American Medical Association, the New England Journal of Medicine, and so on, these journals now have what are called very strict conflict of interest rules. And that means that anybody who submits a paper, a scientific report, to one of these journals has to sign a very, very carefully worded, very comprehensive document stating whether or not they have any conflicts of interest, whether they're taking money from a drug company, for example. And that's especially the medical journals worry about the drug companies, because if a new drug is reported as being extremely beneficial and a lot of people buy the drug and then the drug, in fact, turns out to be harmful, people are going to be killed. And so the medical journals have learned to be very, very careful about this. And concern about conflict of interest is now spread much more widely in the scientific community. And unfortunately, from time to time, people lie. And papers get published and conflicts of interest are not revealed, sometimes never revealed, and sometimes don't come to light until after the fact.
Wow. That's really fascinating. I mean, what is your, having had, you know, many, many decades of distinguished service in the area of science, you know, over several generations, you know, what is your own view about how you've seen the progression of science, where you think we are now, and your hopes and concerns about where we may be headed, for example, in the near or longer future?
Well, I think I'm fundamentally an optimist, and I tend to believe that ultimately the truth will come out. And I've seen this over the years of science. When I started doing work on lead poisoning in children, which was in the early 1970s when I was serving in uniform in the U.S. Public Health Service at the Centers for Disease Control, we were just beginning to discern that low levels of lead exposure could cause brain damage in children. And the lead industry fought that viciously. They found scientists who accepted substantial sums of money and said, no, there's no problem. But the reports showing that there was indeed a problem kept coming in, and finally by 1976, the government had had enough. Still there?
Yep.
Okay. So they took lead out of gasoline, and as you said at the beginning of the show when you were introducing me, that single action of removing lead from gasoline reduced American children's blood levels by more than 90% and raised the average IQ of all American children born since 1980 by about 5 points. It's amazing. We've cleaned up the worst of our air pollution, the air in the United States, the levels of the major pollutants in air are 70% lower than they were in 1970 when we passed the Clean Air Act. So I think in many respects, we're moving in the right direction. Sure, we have work to do. Flint taught us that in case we didn't already know it. But we have made progress, and there are good, honest people out there doing the good work, and they'll keep doing it even though there are always going to be impediments.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great perspective, and I hope that's true. Are you concerned at all about, you know, the current administration with their kind of inhospitable, you know, their inhospitable attitude toward environmental science? I mean, are you seeing similar things in the health arena, or has that been more of a, you know, kind of neutral area, would you say?
No, I've actually spoken out publicly about several of the actions of the current administration, specifically two of the actions of EPA. First of all, I've been strongly critical of EPA's decision to relax the rules on coal-fired power plants. This relaxation of the rules on the power plants is going to allow more particulate pollution to become airborne, higher levels of airborne particulate pollution. And those higher levels of particulate pollution are going to kill people. It's going to result in more cases of asthma and pneumonia in children, more children with low birth weight. And among adults, there are very, very strong connections that have been established between particulate air pollution and heart disease, stroke, lung cancer, cardiac arrhythmias. All of these conditions are going to increase in frequency in the American population as the rules on coal-fired power plants are relaxed. I think it's directly harmful to human health, and the current leadership of EPA is just ignoring the science in their pandering to the people that own those factories. The second action of the current EPA administrator that I've spoken out against very publicly is his decision not to ban the insecticide that goes by the name of chlorpyrifos. Chlorpyrifos is a very widely used insecticide. It kills insects by damaging their nervous systems. It was chemically designed to be harmful to the brain and the nervous system. It's a first cousin. It's a member of the same chemical family as sarin, the war gas that was used in the Tokyo subway attack. And very, very, very high quality studies have shown that when a pregnant woman is exposed to chlorpyrifos, that the chemical passes through to her child in the womb and causes brain damage to the child. It causes loss of IQ, shortening of attention span. And when these children get old enough to be tested for MRI around the age of 10 or 11 years, these children who are exposed in the womb to chlorpyrifos have damage to the brain that is visible on MRI. And despite this abundant evidence, the current leadership of EPA has allowed this stuff to stay on the market, which means that they're allowing children to be subjected unnecessarily to brain damage. So, yes, I think that this administration is not advancing public health.
Where are the areas that we're currently experiencing the negative impacts? You know, children are experiencing the negative impacts of our past policy on environmental toxic chemicals that people might not so frequently associate with that as a cause, but where, you know, the effect of it is seen in a very palpable or obvious manner. I mean, what would you regard as the two most obvious present challenges?
If I had to pick two, I would say that lead and pesticides. Even though we've made great progress against childhood lead poisoning in this country, the CDC reports that more than the Centers for Disease Control reports that more than 500,000 children across the United States still have elevated levels of lead in their blood. So it's very clear that we need to do more about lead. Most of this lead comes from paint, old lead paint, some of it from lead pipes. The other problem that I worry a lot about, that I think is an ongoing hazard for American children, is pesticides, which includes the herbicides that we talked about that are applied to plants that have the potential to cause cancer, and the insecticides that have the potential to cause brain damage, especially prenatal exposure.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time here on Connect the Dots, and, you know, I think we could devote another full hour to this topic, quite frankly, and maybe we'll get a chance to do that. We've been speaking today with Dr. Philip J. Landrigan. He's the author of a new book, Children and Environmental Toxins, What Everyone Needs to Know. It is simply written, very clear, brilliant, highly recommended, and just kind of hot off the press from Oxford University Press. If you're interested in this area, if you're contemplating having a family, if you do have a young family, or if you're even concerned about your own health as an adult, I think it's an essential read. Dr. Landrigan wrote it with his wife, who's also a public health expert, Mary M. Landrigan. You know, thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Dr. Landrigan. This is all invaluable.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And I hope we'll have you back on again. And also, thank you so much for your, you know, outspoken standing up for health and science in the public sector, you know, to protect all our health and especially the health of children in these times. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. See you again next week, and all be well. Thanks. Bye.
Where?